And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Matthew Gwynn back to the program today. When he last stopped by, Matthew and I talked about his debut novel, The Resurrectionist, which went on to become a finalist for the Edgar Award for Best First Novel. W.W. Norton has recently published his second novel, and it's entitled The Scribe. Matthew, The Scribe is set in 1880, and your last novel, The Resurrectionist, was partly set in the 19th century. What's your particular attraction to the American South of this time?
I think it's because that's when you can see the New South being born. I feel like so much has been done with the Civil War. It's certainly not exhausted, but as far as writing battle scenes or what have you, I really like the aftermath of it a great deal more. Again, going back to Shelby Foote saying, if you want to understand America, you have to understand the Civil War. I think that's certainly true, but also Reconstruction and what followed were the bedrock of the contemporary South.
But why, for you, is it so interesting?
I think, especially with this book, Atlanta really got busy rebuilding itself after Sherman so thoroughly destroyed it. And you grow up in a town like that or Columbia, South Carolina, and Sherman is at least came through to my consciousness as a war criminal, not a hero, not a savior of the Union, but a war criminal who killed women and children and all kinds of property. He had his reasons for that, of course. But Atlanta and that phoenix image of emerging from the ashes really defines Atlanta in 1881 was very much like Atlanta in 1981, as far as the intellectual history and of the town itself, how Atlantans define themselves. You know, a lot of technology came in. Delta Airlines came in the 1950s, but basically Atlanta was always trying to be the biggest, the best, the fastest, the first, the premier city of the South, same way in 1881 as in, say, Ted Turner's era.
The book does involve a serial killer.
Yes.
And so are there echoes of Wayne Williams, do you think, in the story?
That is a really good perceptive question. I tried not to manipulate that because that was so real. But I grew up in the Atlanta of that era. It's 7 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? And as this serial killer progressed, I thought it was creeping in unconsciously. I became aware of it. But the sense of one person, one specter, one evil man putting the whole city on edge, I was trying to capture that.
Well, I was really surprised to learn that at this time, Atlanta had only been a city for just a little over 40 years. It doesn't go back into the colonies. It was called Terminus.
And then Marthasville, then Atlanta. Yes, it was just the place in the woods where the lines terminated. I think definitely southward and westward. And the city had such hard luck. What became Vicksburg and Atlanta, it seems in my study of the Civil War, those were the two death blows to the Confederacy. I know Richmond was big, but those were the two where this could not go on. And when Atlanta was just completely disabled as a rail center, it had to start all over. But you had some incredible people, boosters trying to build the city up, and you're correct, there wasn't this old Atlanta aristocracy that goes back to 1785, say, the founding of University of Georgia. Atlanta was the woods then. It was Cherokee Nation.
And at that time in 1881, maybe 40,000 people?
That sounds about right.
There are nice little bits of sly humor in the story that just kind of refer to what you think of Atlanta now. People say, I have to go to Buckhead or I have to go to Decatur. It's all the way out there.
Right. And, you know, the travel was so much different then. But Buckhead really did get its name from an old taxidermy buck's head out front of a tavern owned by Henry Irby. And that was Buckhead. And that was basically the tavern, the inn, where you would stop over if you couldn't make it on into Atlanta on that day's travel.
The story is essentially that of Thomas Canby. And the main part of the story, September 1881, he is in Ringgold, Georgia, which is outside of Chattanooga, just across the border. And he's kind of in an exile from Atlanta.
Yes, based on Dante's exile from Florence, which Dante's Inferno was the structural inspiration for this book. And some would say Matthew Gwynn seriously overreaching his talent, but hey, you got to aim for the fences, swing for the fences.
I have to say I wasn't smart enough to pick up on that.
Well, hopefully it's not necessary, but adds to the reading. But yes, going back to, I think we talked last time about Larry Brown and sandbagging your characters, just giving them so many woes and problems to deal with. What struck me for Thomas Canby's character, who is an orphan, a grown orphan, but was made an orphan when he was not grown, how awful would it be to have to try and reclaim your name from being slandered and something you didn't do? An honest man unjustly accused of graft, which was the case for Dante. It was a total political setup, and it winds up being a setup for Thomas Canby in my book as well. But I thought that is a real motivation to try and get reclaim one's honor and get your name back, your good name back. And it seemed that as I thought of Canby, that would be his number one motivation.
Did the thought of riffing on Dante come first, or did the story come to you first?
Dante came first, yes. And I'm hoping the people of Atlanta don't hold it against me too much that I cast Atlanta as hell. And I am a son of Atlanta, so I don't mean it entirely pejoratively, but...
But if you go to Sherman's destruction of the town, it would seem very much like hell.
Very much like hell, the way he left it. I just thought, wouldn't it be great to do something based on Inferno? And then the image of Thomas Canby shooting the mountain lion in the opening pages came to me very early and very much complete. Then I had to say, what does this mean?
When I went back and I was writing my questions, I was looking at the opening chapters again, and I see the scene with the mountain lion, or they probably called it a panther back then, and that he's careless with essentially the way he deals with the mountain lion after he shot it. And you see that kind of resonates throughout. He doesn't take proper care with dealing with dangerous things.
Correct. In Dante, there's a wolf, a lion, and a panther. And the panther, a lot of the scholars think, symbolizes the sin of pride. And I tried in that scene for Canby to be hoping to reclaim his name and be so eager out of pride. And I wouldn't call it a sinful pride, but just being jealous of his honor, that he rushes into some things where if he'd sat back and given it another few moments of thought, he might have let that situation float on by.
This is not the very beginning of the book. The very beginning of the book is an excerpt from his papers. And from this, we gather that he survives what's coming up.
Right.
So you take a little bit of the dramatic tension out of us that way.
Mm-hmm. Although we don't know in the end how long he will survive. Three of these characters are going to Birmingham for the next book. And we will see at what point, I guess I did put it in there, he was retired from the Atlanta police force. So I'll have to figure out a way to get him up to the gold watch party.
He has been removed from the Atlanta police force, and he receives a telegram from his old boss, Vernon Thomas, and his reply to him is pretty curt.
Yes, yes, go back to hell, as it were. Yes, he felt like even though Chief Vernon was his mentor and who taught him, he was a little bit of a Mephistopheles. He managed to negotiate all the politics of Atlanta without getting scathed, as Thomas did. So Thomas has a real love-hate relationship with his mentor that way.
And so there's a promise of no politics. And that's the worst promise that's so poorly kept. It's crazy because it's nothing but politics.
Yes, that promise wasn't even kept past maybe the second hour that Canby was back into Atlanta.
Now, on the way back into town, he stops in a place called Vining's, which is probably halfway between Atlanta and Marietta. Mm-hmm. And he has an old flame named Julia, and he just wants to check in and see how she's doing because he left under bad circumstances.
Correct, and he felt even though he had some obligations to her, he didn't want to besmirch her name with his supposed crimes. But Vining's to me is a point in the novel that's not at all hellish. There's the mountain there. It's the part of Atlanta I grew up in. A lot of the things described in the Vining's of 1881 are still there if you know where to look. But I saw that as his sort of purgatory with this good woman, Julia, who is a school teacher and, as they say, doing some good in the world. and she brings out the best in Canby. And so that's a safe place for him to go and be recharged before he goes into Atlanta.
Canby does make some dumb decisions, and one of them is not telling Julia why he's leaving.
I guess so. Why he's leaving before?
Or yeah, didn't he not tell her?
He didn't really explain it to her.
He just kind of left.
Yes, yes. He's damaged goods. I think that's one of the tropes of detective fiction that I like best, is how do you create this flawed hero who nonetheless is a hero, hopefully, to your readers and to yourself? Which ways would he push people away? And I think, what's the great D.H. Lawrence quote? The essential American soul is hard, stoic, isolate, a killer. It has never melted. I think that's about what he said. But there's an element of that in all the good American detective protagonists, that element of being the cowboy, being alone.
Also, at that beginning section from his papers, he refers to evil. And we learn through the course of the book, it's a word he does not take lightly. He reserves it for only the truly worst things in the world.
Indeed. I wanted this to be kind of a meditation. I've really grappled with Ralph Waldo Emerson over the years, because so much of what he said is beautiful and true, and yet in one passage he says, even the corpse has its beauty, which he just denied evil. And I thought it would be interesting for Canby to have a similar perspective, similar kind of rationalism or progressivism, and then to contrast that with Cyrus Underwood, who has a more visceral faith in good and evil, who doesn't mince words or split hairs over it.
Because he could even view Sherman's march through Atlanta in context of war, even though he hates Sherman with a passion. But he views the war as just a result of flawed people doing flawed things.
Right. Power conflicting with power over power. And it's interesting that you bring up what Sherman did on his march, because on the one hand, it's just really wicked. Civilians were killed. What we call collateral damage. He knew that was happening and said if they didn't evacuate Atlanta, then women and children are going to die. To me, that seems very clearly in the wrong. And yet, that ended the war in much the same way that dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki ended World War II. It just broke the Confederates' resolve to keep fighting. So is it evil? Is it not? Very difficult question to answer satisfactorily.
What did Dante think of such maneuvers?
Dante believed in a very medieval system of good and evil, and there was a plus column and a negative column. I guess he would have said in making exceptions to help out family, one could then do the wrong thing for the greater good. But otherwise, it was very clear. It's fascinating reading Dante because there's not much moral uncertainty at all. In the work, the character of Dante is pained by how much people are suffering in hell. But Virgil, his guide, says everybody knew the stakes of this game when they were upstairs on the planet. Your pity is misplaced.
We don't know the stakes of the game. We can only guess at what happens afterwards.
Yeah. I'm really drawn to that medieval certainty, because with Dante anyway, it's not really reductive. One of the impetuses of this book is how much educated people of our time mince around the word evil. They'll talk about ideology. 9/11 was an ideological conflict. I just want to get on top of the table and shout, no, it was evil. If you can't call that evil, what kind of swamp are we lost in?
Also in The Scribe, there are a lot of references to other books. Very rarely do I see books that actually let other books kind of be part of the story. And books are very important to everyone.
That was part of, I think, Canby being such an ideal character to me. He had a wonderful relationship with his father, who was brought him over from Ireland and was a Methodist minister and opened a schoolhouse and taught Latin and Greek and taught at Emory until Fort Sumter. And then he ran afoul of the student body and most of the faculty. But the notion of the books and the learning being part of this masculine world to me is just so attractive. James Dickey used to say one time, I guess it was when Hemingway got blown up in the ambulance in the war, he told a nurse, "I think I could recover more quickly if you had put me in a room with books instead of this sterile hospital room." And I love the blend of those things, masculinity and books, physical action and what country people call book learning.
Because it seems to be absent from our culture nowadays.
It's a shame. I spoke at the Decatur Book Festival and mentioned something to a crowded room about until the media makes Kardashians out of all of us. The groan that went across the room almost spooked me. All these book people were just repulsed at the idea of us all getting down to that level of just 40 selfies a day or what have you.
Well, recently, Kim Kardashian was on, I think, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR. And there was just this huge, virulent reaction against it. And I listened to the segment, and she came across fairly well. I mean, it was not bad what she did. I don't watch her show. I can't even comment if it's good or bad because I've never seen it. Mm-hmm. It's just something I don't think I would like. So I think there's something in that reaction. I think there's something a little bit disingenuous in that too, though, in the reaction against.
I guess so. I guess they just, to so many people, just represent just out and out, everything's for sale, vulgarity. Subscribed to Rolling Stone and read the cover story with her, and it just seemed like there was nothing there except for commerce in the story that I read. You know, she's very good at using digital media to move products and so forth, but there seemed, I didn't detect a soul.
But I mean, I think this might go back to even a pre-intellectual state of humanity. You know, everything is, can you get the food? Can you provide the protection? I mean, it boils human existence down to a certain type of essence. I don't think it's a new thing, and I don't think it's a unique thing. I think it's one very strong part of humanity.
The old hunter-gatherer. I'm trying to think of a good title. Hunter-gatherer, web surfer. You know?
Now, when he gets down to Atlanta, Vernon lets him know why he's there. And there have been a couple of horrific murders. And we are talking top shelf, really bad stuff here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I didn't want to mince that. One of those murders was, in reality, the barber was found nearly in that shape that I described. Atlanta had some horrific real-life murders that sort of showcased what a frontier town it still was, even into the 1880s, but yes, as part of the putting a name to evil, as Andrew Lytle said, is look at this crime scene and just see. And some of the research I did was looking at Jack the Ripper's crime scenes, and you can't unsee those photographs. And you know what you're dealing with here is something just demonic.
Jack the Ripper would be another 7 years down the road from this time. And with the International Cotton Exposition happening, there's definitely a feeling of Devil in White City in there, too.
I really enjoyed that book. I read that book when it came out at the recommendation of a friend and really liked the juxtaposition and the tension between the optimism of this fair and what's going on underneath it. And I thought, let's just up the stakes of what this killer is doing from the real-life Devil in the White City.
And it's the International Cotton Exposition that is the complicating factor in this, because normally if you have these horrific crimes, hopefully you deal with them in a fairly straightforward way, but they're putting so much of Atlanta's future on this, essentially a world's fair in itself, mm-hmm. and inviting the world to come see the New South, that you can't scare people away with this horrific stuff.
Right. And in life, that real exposition, Sherman bought stock in it, and they did bring him down. And they did make him a suit from cotton that was picked that morning, and it was ginned and carded and all of that spun and woven into a suit for him to wear to a banquet that night. There was so much wonderful material in the real 1881 cotton exposition that I wanted to put as much of that in as I could. And also the notion that, yes, you've got the typical politicos want it to go away, keep it quiet, but also a lot of the preeminent American historians think that that was the birth of the New South, was the 1881 International Cotton Exposition.
And many of those involved with it were in a group called The Ring.
Which existed, which was real, yes.
So tell us about The Real Ring.
The Real Ring was as Henry Grady, the editor, New South prophet and editor of the Atlanta Journal Constitution, and for whom the journalism school is named at the University of Georgia, he really said, "Atlantans don't care if a man has ability if he was hatched in a stump." I just went through the histories, and Henry Grady was such a larger-than-life character, but a lot of the members of the ring hadn't been in Atlanta very long. One of them actually got drummed out of town on corruption charges and managed to come back and get a group of investors together and build another new hotel. But they were movers and shakers, and they were looking to make a dollar.
What do you have to do to get drummed out of a town for corruption in the 19th century?
Good question. I don't want to name a name and be wrong, because these were real people, but I think it was a bribery charge to get government contracts is what it was. He must have really gotten caught.
It was politics that got Canby kicked off the force originally, because he was not a good Democrat. He was anti-secesh.
Yes, Reconstruction came in, and the Republicans were given so many offices. But what the ring and Henry Grady and those people did was, by 1877, they had gotten a political pact together, I guess. And they called themselves the Redeemers, which sounds wonderful. But basically, they redeemed the South or Atlanta from radical Republican rule. And for African-American Atlantans, they turned the clock back 20 years almost overnight, with the election that they won, and put their people, the Democrats, back in power. So they called themselves the Redeemers, but they were definitely wanting to get things back to home rule and we know what's best.
Because 1881 is 5 years after the end of Reconstruction, essentially. Mm-hmm. So can you go into a little more depth on what life was like for African Americans right there at that transition point from the end of Reconstruction going into Jim Crow?
Well, one thing that I've always been proud about Atlanta, of course, they'll tell you the city too busy to hate, but Atlanta has always had more opportunities for African Americans than I've seen in other parts of the South. I don't know Memphis, so I don't know how to comment on that, but there were some African Americans really doing very, very well once Reconstruction gave them a shot at it. The Redeemers turned some of them back in time. Others they left alone. But it was always a city where you have to look at the bigger picture and say, this is so far from perfect. But there was always more opportunity in Atlanta for African-American citizens than most other, I guess I should say, the smaller towns in Georgia.
I would guess because land was not as important in town.
Right, right. And Atlanta was, you know, as Thomas Canby says in the preface, the planters who came in after the war, who had gone bust, to see that there was nothing here in Atlanta for their kind, same as before, i.e. same as it ever was. And Atlanta was not built. It was built on industry and commerce. That involved cotton, but the irony of the International Cotton Exposition is the main thing that they were showcasing was technology. In other words, to process cotton here in the South rather than send it to the textile mills of New England to be woven. The idea was, and Henry Grady was huge on this, let's not be purely agricultural. That didn't work, and it didn't work in the Civil War. Let's industrialize and modernize. And that wound up being the main theme of Atlanta's history.
Now, we mentioned Cyrus Underwood, and he is the first African-American policeman on the Atlanta force, and he has been paired up with Canby to investigate the murders, because both murders so far, when he comes down, have been African-American victims. But Vernon says to him, I don't trust this guy, because he's been too close to the areas of the murders before. You know, he was a little too quick on the scene.
And also he doesn't trust him because he's not content just to push a broom as the janitor at the police station. Vernon calls him a striver. And that's one of the most interesting things about writing in this period, is you don't want to write this presentist where there are just glowing liberal white people who love African Americans and want to be their salvation. You have to say, what kind of prejudice would there be in somebody like the police chief of Atlanta back then, even if he knew that sooner, if not later, black Atlantans were going to be voting in elections, and what kind of prejudice would a progressive like Thomas Canby have that he wouldn't be able to see beyond his era, even if he were as liberal as he thought he could be? In what ways would he also suspect Cyrus Underwood? Hopefully that came across. I tried to put it in there that the main thing that Vernon didn't like was that this Cyrus Underwood didn't know his place and was not going to be content being told what his place was.
It's a theme that you worked with in your first book in The Resurrectionist as well, is that we have basically good characters, but they are very blind in dealing with huge topics such as race.
Right. And I think that's only fair in writing historical novels. You know, we're blind to God knows what today. What are we not getting our heads around that we haven't evolved to? And you want to make it interesting with the historical characters where they're flawed, but only a few monsters.
Now, you mentioned Grady, and there are a few other historical personages that pop up. You also mentioned Sherman, but seeing Joel Chandler Harris pop up just in a very small part was nice, considering that, you know, he was so huge of his time and has really kind of slipped into obscurity nowadays.
Mm-hmm. We took the kids to Disney World 6 or 7 years ago and did the Song of the South ride, which is basically should be copyright Joel Chandler Harris, and I'm kind of amazed it still exists. But
yeah, I mean, how do they work around all the problematic racial things in that?
I would need to go back through it again to get my head around the whole thing. I guess they removed some stuff, but Harris really was quite the character and quite the Atlantan, quite the Southerner. You know, more contemporary example of him would be Louis Grizzard in our time.
Who was problematic in a lot of ways, too.
In a lot of ways, too. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you do talk in your author's note at the end of the book that you kind of play a little fast and loose with some facts, especially about timing of technologies and such. So what's your general view on accuracy in historical fiction?
That is, that's the biggest liability to trying to write one of these. James Lee Burke said, you know, a guy just trying to write an honest novel will get panned for this or that. And he was generous enough to blurb the book. He found an error with one of my pistols at the 9th hour that I was able to change. Those kind of errors are generally unacceptable. You're going to make a few. You can't bat 1,000. But as far as people forgetting that it's historical fiction, there's not a helicopter in my book or a flying saucer or a cell phone. But I did move a few things, just a few years, that it seemed to me made the story so much better that accuracy would have just been pedantic and dull as far as not borrowing from these.
But when you're dealing with the past and these investigations, and you want to be, you're treating them seriously, intellectually, and then to say, well, that's just not convenient. I mean, how much of a cop-out is that?
Well, I admitted to all three of the manipulations. So anything else in there has eluded me. But one of those that involves a lynching without giving anything away happened 25 years later. But that lynching was such a pivotal, dark, dark moment in Atlanta's history that if I'm writing a book, a historical novel about evil in Atlanta, and I move something that happened in 1915 back to 1881, I don't feel bad about that. And especially the way we don't tend in our era to give history a proper hearing. I certainly grew up in Atlanta and never learned about that lynching in class. It needs not to be forgotten. So in that case, I deliberately moved that and have no apologies for it. A couple of the others, just technology, nothing too major, but it's really, so to speak, shed light on one of the characters in a way that I thought was justified.
Your first book, The Resurrectionist, was a finalist for an Edgar Award when it came out. Were you surprised that you were nominated in a mystery award setting?
I was delighted. I knew Norton had submitted it. The publishers just send in books, and they get read and picked. I was really delighted to quote Joel Chandler Harris. I thought, well, throw me in that briar patch. If that's a mystery novel. My wife Kristen and I went up to the banquet, and it was wonderful. We met Lee Child, Jeffrey Deaver, all these people who've been making a living with their pens for years and years and years. So that was really nice. But this one I always intended to be a detective novel. As soon as I put Canby the character together with Dante, I thought, let's make it a detective book. So this one was more consciously trying to be a mystery. But I was delighted for The Resurrectionist, and it was probably the best thing that ever happened for that book, the exposure from that. It's wonderful.
When I went back and listened to our old interview today, you talked about writing this book, and you had another title for it at the time that I'm not going to give away because I think it ruins a lot.
Yes.
And I'm really glad that you changed the title of the book because I went, oh my God, that's such just a giveaway right there.
You never want to fall into the cliches of a genre. You know, you never want to write a typical mystery. I hate the books where I can see what's coming. And that working title did reveal the message that the killer was trying to convey. And I thought that was fresh as far as giving you half the identity of the murderer. My editor disagreed. I'm glad that she did, because every arrow you can keep in your quiver when writing a plotted novel or a suspenseful novel, you need to hold on to it. Andrew Lytle had a book called A Name for Evil, and that working title was My Name for Evil. So it is revealed here much later on, and I agree with you. If you have a good editor, it's a collaborative process writing a book. And the first draft, the publisher would be doing you a great disservice to just rubber stamp that first draft and say, let's print this.
And the scribe can apply to several people throughout the book.
Yes.
And let's not forget the killer who has been carving initials into people's foreheads as the bodies pile up.
Right. And then we have the book opening and closing with excerpts from Thomas Canby's papers, and then Cyrus Underwood is kind of the recorder of this case.
The amanuensis.
The sable amanuensis. That's right. So the scribe is a more apt title. I owe a lot to Kristen for that one.
So do you have another book in the works right now?
I do indeed. Red Mountain, which follows three of these characters to Birmingham and deals with the evils of the convict lease system, which I didn't know much about until I stumbled across it, but it was a system much worse than slavery for African-American men in the Deep South, especially Alabama. Alabama practiced this up to the 1940s, and companies that manufactured coal and iron could lease these convicts at such incredibly low rates that eventually the constables and sheriffs of several Alabama counties started arresting people on vagrancy charges, the kind of charge...
Just to supply labor.
And the most troubling thing about it is even if you do hear a white southerner of a certain older generation try to make an excuse for slavery in some paternalistic terms, well, all pretense of taking care of anybody was off with the convict lease. The labor was so cheap that they lost men weekly in the mines and just contacted law enforcement and said, we need more labor. They actually had very nearly mass graves near some of these mines in Birmingham in the 19th century where they didn't even bother to return the body. So that is something I never read in a textbook that needs to be told. So
certainly with the image of the foundries, you have more hell.
More hell, indeed. Absolutely. And we lived in Birmingham for 7 years, and that's when I first got a little bit of exposure to what a wonderful and terrible city that has been historically, how many good things it's done, but on the backs of people who were just woefully exploited.
Well, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing The Scribe with us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Stephen.
Matthew Gwynn is the author of The Scribe, which is published by W.W. Norton. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.